zephyrs around me blow, bend and sway me to and fro, cause my soul in truth to roam, and from wrong be turning. Heavenly zephyrs around me blow, bend and sway me to and fro, cause my soul in truth to roam, and from wrong be turning.
All right, you have tuned into the WGXC Afternoon Show, and this is the debut of the Shaker Show. And we are joined today by Sarah Van Buren, Dana Russo, Dana Russo, and Jerry Grant of Shaker Museum. You guys are going to tell us everything about Shakers this afternoon. I guess starting with, what was that song that we just heard?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having us. That song is called Yielding and Simple. And it's actually from a record that was put out by Rounder Records in the year. Jerry, do you remember the year?
70s.
Called Early Shaker Spirituals. And we will be hearing more from that record.
All right. So a lot of people in this area know about Shakers, but why don't you guys give us some of the basics?
Thank you, Tom. It's very nice to be here. And I think it's always hard to start this off, but if people live in this area, they probably know Shaker something, because there are roads named after that and schools named after that in the area. So you've heard that word, but it basically refers to a group of people who were a church, a Protestant monastic communal society that originated near Manchester, England, around the mid-1700s. They were part of a bigger movement in England that was a reaction against the Church of England's tight thumb on people's ability to have their own spiritual experiences. It's the same group, the same kind of movement out of which the much better known group that we know as Methodists now came. And the Shakers were probably part of that early group, but they split off from them. They were in England. They were never a group of more than 30 or 40 people. And at some time, because they refused to register as dissidents with the Church of England, they were abused and punished and imprisoned. And as a reaction to that, they, a very small group of them, led by their leader, who was a woman named Ann Lee, decided to make their way to America, where they, like so many other religious groups, felt they would have a lot more freedom to worship in the way that they felt was fulfilling to their own needs.
And what era was that? What time frame?
The Shakers really originated, again, in the mid-1700s. The decision to come to America was in the 1774. So this year is the 250th anniversary of their decision to come to America. They sailed from Liverpool, England, to New York City, and landed in New York City on August 6th. So this will be a year in which all of the Shaker museums in the country, and there are a number of those, and all those people who have written about the Shakers and associate with some aspect of Shaker life or Shaker history, will have cause to celebrate. So we're expecting this to be a pretty exciting year.
So I think of Shakers, New Lebanon, Massachusetts, Albany County, that kind of area. But you said it's all over the country. Was this the largest group, or why did they come here too?
So I think the Shakers came here because they, back when they came here in the 1770s, this was the place to come. If you didn't go to the Virginia colonies or south, you were going to come to New York or New England or Pennsylvania. I think they felt that They were coming to New York City, and probably the easiest place for them to find a place to settle would have been to come up the old North River, which we now, for some reason, call the Hudson, and find land someplace up along that area because of the land ownership at the time. They ended up coming all the way up to near Watervliet, New York, which is where they were able to purchase enough land to start a small settlement. And the Shakers came here. There were only eight of them that came.
Wow.
So it was a very small group of people.
And then more came because it worked? Or?
I think mostly it was just a process. There were not that many left in England. Most of those people just disbanded and joined other groups or returned to the Church of England. And so most of what happened to the Shakers after they got here was just they made converts. They had a compelling message for people who were expecting that America would be a place where all of their religious and spiritual dreams would be fulfilled. So the Shakers came with a message that the second coming of Christ had already occurred, not in that a person had appeared, but rather that that spirit of Christ had was within every person. And as such, the Shakers said, you can all be part of this group by merely recognizing that there is that spirit within you and acting accordingly, which for the Shakers was to give up a lot of yourself, to bond together in community, to love one another, and to take care of each other.
And that was a very radical message at the time?
It was a radical message, especially delivered by a woman at the time.
Oh, they were led by a woman?
Led by a woman.
So I can't think of too many other religions led by women in that era,
there were a few, and most of them were unsuccessful, and didn't last that long. The Shakers have had an incredible longevity. We can talk about that more. But
did they have similar opposition in the United States, or it wasn't even the United States then?
They did, and I mean, the Shakers, because they were announcers of the second coming, that flew in the face of most of the organized churches who were expecting that to come in a very different form. Because they were led by a woman, they had opposition. The Shakers also lived a celibate life. They did not marry. They did not have children. And that was a threat to the natural family. They also were communal, so it was a threat to sort of good old American, beginning of American capitalism. So on about every front, they had a struggle, and people tried to interfere with them in any way that they could. So Ann Lee and some of her followers were jailed, and the Shakers were generally, as they would...
And what were the charges?
Oh, I can't even remember.
They were British, and it was before 1776. It was right around the time that if you were a loyalist, you were in trouble. So that didn't help them either.
They would refuse to say one way or the other what their political...
So both sides assumed they were for the other side.
Yeah, right. I think that's probably most of it, yeah.
Did things change after the war?
I think it changed after the war, only that they were more free to move around. New England became easier to move around in. So in 1780, a small band of Shakers started doing a missionary tour through New England. So they went through Connecticut and skipped Rhode Island, and a lot of Quakers. Went through...
The landscape was, religious landscape was very different at the time, right?
Very different. And the Shakers happened to settle where there was a lot of people who had already moved to the hills of the Taconics and the Berkshires to get away from the established churches in Massachusetts and Connecticut. So there were congregations of people here who were looking for, they were called new lights, looking for a new light in a way to have their religious life. So the Shakers traveled through Connecticut, Massachusetts. They sent missionaries up into New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine, and were able to make a number of converts.
They went house to house, or did they have revival meetings?
Often what they would do is if there was some kind of an opening for them to go and gather with a group and it felt like people would want to listen to them. Somebody would give up and talk, get up and talk about what it meant to be a Shaker, what they were talking about. So that was probably the easiest way, and there were people that were receptive. In the town of New Lebanon, where there were already revivals of religion going on among a lot of these New Light groups, there was one particular minister, his whole congregation basically became Shakers. And people would hear, you know, they were a curiosity, which meant that people would go and they were curious because of their woman leadership. They were curious because they danced during their religious services.
So it was a little like the Amish today curious?
A lot more like the Quakers that people remembered in the old days when Quakers would be moved by the Spirit to have physical manifestations of what was going on with them inside their spiritual motives. So people would come and just inquire and see what was going on, and some of them liked it. So people would stay. They were looking for a solid place to connect with another community that would sort of allow them to be. I think the sacrifices people made to become Shakers were pretty great, but the reward was a supportive community and a guaranteed place in heaven. So, which is what a lot of people were looking for at that time. Some assurance.
It seems like it's a little less mystical, like there's fewer like ghosts and people returning from the dead. It seems like more grounded in reality from what you described.
Oh, no,
they've got some mystical stuff.
Well,
we're not
talking ghosts here, but the Shakers. There's a song that I think we're not including today that it really talks about the parallel between this world and the next world, and it's a very thin line for the Shakers about the earth and heaven, and they cross over that line fairly closely. So when people die, the Shakers would say they merely they were harvested to a better life or to a better place. That was the reward for being a Shaker. So. And in fact, then they would have communications from that other world. The Shaker song had a line that was, heavens and earth are blending. And I think that's how Shakerism was. So there was an interesting thing about that is people talk about the decline of Shakers through time. And in fact, there are fewer people in this world. But because Shakers merely go to the next world, there can't really be a decline. They can only increase in numbers. And if you count those in the spirit world, which I think the Shakers would, there is one active Shaker community still in the country. It's at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine. There are two members.
Wow.
So it's a fairly small church now. But they have a pretty supportive faith community that surrounds them, and that there are a number of people that get something from being connected to the Shakers that are not yet willing to make that or have not been willing to make the commitment to really be part of Shaker life. So they're not alone up there. There's not two lonely people. There's quite a community of support and there. But I think every Sunday they have a public worship at 10 o'clock, and that usually starts off with prayers for an increase in vocations, that they are hoping that there will be people out there that will still want to become members. So,
and can you describe that, a service?
Mm-hmm. The services now are different than they would have been in 1820, but 1824, but basically they start with a song. There's a welcome by Brother Arnold, who's the male member of the community, and scripture readings and another song. And then it's a series of, generally for about an hour, of somebody making a testimony. And in response to the testimony, somebody will often start up a Shaker-written song that is something often in response to what the person had to say. The testimony may be in reaction to the scriptures. It may be just something somebody feels, something somebody just wants to say. So it's pretty loose. There's no, it's not a conversation. There's never a an argument going on about what somebody said. It's not debate. It's just you have the freedom to just say something. And the song is a nice break to sort of keep that from happening and turning into a conversation.
And you said, did they, when they originally formed back in England, did they split from Methodism or how did they?
It's really pretty unclear. Most of the early Shakers that we can identify had some relationship with what was the very beginnings of the Methodist Church. Methodists would gather in what they called, I'm just blanking, that's okay, I'm getting old.
Methodists
but they would gather together in people's homes, so it would be...
Because they weren't allowed in England either, right?
No, except that John Wesley agreed to be a dissident group, so they were left alone. Which is, I think, the falling out that the Shakers had with Wesley was he shouldn't have given in to the church, because that then would... I'm not a religious historian, so I'm sort of talking
right
here, but that would influence the spirit that a person felt individually to have to sort of be under the thumb of the church still. But a lot of those people did have some connection to the Methodists. It's interesting, in the 1760s, somebody who witnessed their physical exercises during worship called them Shaking Quakers, as a way of sort of identifying that they looked like the Shakers, of like the Quakers of old, who would be moved by the Spirit to shake or tremble or quake, I guess. And that word, Shaking Quakers, stuck with them for a while. Their official name was the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing. And that United Society may have been connected to their Methodist roots, in that when people in the Methodist Church in the early days gathered, they gathered at people's homes. So you'd be the United Society of Tom Rowe, I mean, if they gathered at your house. And I think probably that's where the United Society concept came from, the Shakers. But this has not been documented really well yet. There are those of us who just feel like there's always a desire to try to connect the Shakers to the Quakers. But the research that was done by some of the Shakers who went over to England and tried to track down their early roots really found no connection with any Quaker meetings in any of the early Shakers.
So it was more the outsiders saying that the two groups were similar because they didn't really know what they were talking about.
I think in a way of just explaining what this new group was like, yeah.
Because they were people were familiar with Quakers. Yeah.
And for some reason, the Shakers, in their literature and their writing about their own history, decided to take up the Quaker name because I think for them, they didn't want to be associated. This is me making this up. They didn't want to be associated with the Methodists. They didn't want to just be lumped in with that new group, which is also very active in America at that time.
So it's unknown, but it's likely probably someone else named the group Shakers. And
yes,
that name stuck because it's much easier to remember than United Society of I've forgotten
right
the end already.
Right, see. yes, and in fact, in the early days when Shakers were doing business, they didn't necessarily use the Shaker name, but by the 18-teens, 1820s, they start marketing themselves and their products as Shakers.
So less than 50 years in this country, they were Shakers.
Yeah, very much so.
And did the Shakers change over the years? They started out as one thing, and you described the service sort of changing.
It's interesting. I mean, Shakerism evolves in terms of some of their worship practices and such. I mean, they gave up the dancing when the community got to be to the point where there were not that many of them and they were aged. And so they went from sort of ecstatic dancing to... by 1800, that becomes regulated into set dances that they practiced and learned. They would have public meetings so people could come and watch them do this and listen to their music and listen to their testimonies. To the late 19th century, when they're doing just marches which were less strenuous than the kind of dances that they were doing before, till now, where they don't do any kind of that kind of dancing in their services at all. But there's still the music and testimony. People would be invited in. They wanted the public to come to see, and they hoped that some of those people who would come and witness their public meetings would be moved to come and join. And it must have worked. I mean, people joined. The Shakers went from... It's interesting, they came in 1774. By 1784, when their leader, Ann Lee, died, I'm just thinking about how quietly they probably came to America. But by the time of her death, her obituary appeared in over a dozen newspapers in New England. So she had become quite well known and become newsworthy. Articles started appearing in the late 1700s on the Shakers on a pretty regular basis in the common press. So,
was it? I mean, I guess there were many. You know, the Mormons formed vaguely this time.
A little later.
Yeah, but yeah. So there were religions popping up. Was it normal for a religion to be that popular in that short? I mean, 10 years. That's pretty.
Not a religious scholar, Tom. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know. Other people could answer that question.
It seems quick, doesn't it?
It seems that they went from a group of just a few people to by the 1820s, by the mid 1820s, probably three or 4,000, and they're spread out in communities in these communes. So there were communities, the ones that we know best here is in New Lebanon, New York. Which was an area that was just ripe for evangelizing and making new members.
It was named New Lebanon because it was a
town of the town of New Lebanon was a town that
for religious freedom.
Well, it was just a town, and it became a town that had some churches where a lot of converts were made, and they were having revivals there. So. The Shakers, that was their first really major settlement, although when they first got here, they first settled up north of Water Bleet in Niskayuna, and that became one of their communities as well. So New York had, in the early days, had a community in the Albany area and one in New Lebanon. And just over the mountain at Hancock, which is another museum now, that became a settlement, and a settlement in Tieringham, Massachusetts, one in Harvard, Massachusetts, one in Shirley, Massachusetts. They ranged up to Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, and Alfred, Maine, and Canterbury, New Hampshire, and Enfield, New Hampshire, and just really spread out pretty well throughout New England. And these are communities of any place from 250 to 600 people. And the Shakers in those communities are arranged into family groups. And so a Shaker communal family may be from 30 to 110 people.
That weren't necessarily related.
They're not necessarily related, although there are a lot of blood relationships among the Shakers because families would join. And families, you know, the demographics of the area were that families would be members of a church, and they would also then, if they became Shakers, number of people from that family would join. I don't know what the percentage would be of Shakers who shared some blood relationship with another Shaker, but it's probably pretty high in the early days.
And if you moved your family, you said your family wants to become a Shaker family, and so then do you move into one of these communities? Mm-hmm. And how does that happen? Do they come together and build you a house, or is it communal? Capitalist? Is it socialist? Is it?
It's small c communist, yes, in that. You know, you all work and you all benefit from your labor. So I think that the buildings were communal. They were large structures. So men and women lived in. I often say, and I don't think it's really all that fair, but it's like a nunnery and a monastery sort of jammed together in the same building. You have men and women living a celibate life, but they're in the same building divided by maybe just a hallway. Not even on separate floors or separate ends of a building, which is...
That seems usually unusual for celibate situations. They usually separate everyone,
right.
the sexes,
exactly.
I mean.
and the Shakers did it only by expectation. So there is a real certainly one of the things over the years that drew me and drew my interest in the Shakers was that incredible commitment that people made. It was a powerful commitment to make towards that kind of a life. And I think that, you know, these are pretty common people making a pretty substantial commitment to live a certain way. And I think that these days we make those people those kind of committed people into heroes, I think, you know, because it seems unusual now.
What did they do with a family joins and you're 5 or 6 years old, you maybe don't understand what you're joining, you get older.
When a family would join, the husband and wife would have to have agreed to basically break their marital bonds. So they've already made that agreement, and their children would be taken in. If they had children, their children would be taken in and put under the supervision of caretakers, a male or a female caretaker.
So they're no longer parents?
They're no longer parents.
Wow.
Could be attractive for some people. Yes,
obviously it was, right?
Obviously it worked out. But people did join with the children. The Shakers eventually were willing to take in children, orphans, and to try to raise them to become Shakers. That never worked out as well as they would like to have had it do. Some of the best Shakers, some of the ones we admire the most these days and historically made the most significance, were the children of those parents who made a commitment to live that life because they were brought up in that system and understood it and really could commit themselves to it and were comfortable with it all. I think people coming in as converts always come in with baggage. So you've got to, that's the extra fight, you know, you've got to get rid of that too. So. Mm.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Jerry Grant of Shaker Museum. You're the executive director?
Or I am not. I am the director of collections and research. Director. So I'm in charge of the stuff.
And we're also speaking with Dana Rasso. What is your role?
I am the communications manager at the museum, and I oversee the way we present ourselves, both online, on social media, and the way we often talk about ourselves as Shaker Museum. And I did want to say something about Mother Anne, because it speaks to her charisma, I think, and that is that she was illiterate and spoke, apparently, though, with such conviction and in such a way as to convert people that illiteracy didn't matter. The other thing I wanted to bring up, and Jerry, you know, you're welcome to interject and correct me. One of the reasons why celibacy was one of the founding principles of Shakers is that Anne Lee herself experienced the deaths of 4 children at a very young age, and she was very traumatized by it, and she also was traumatized by the act of sex. It felt as though it was an affront to God, and I think that was what compelled her to declare the importance of celibacy. And I can imagine that celibacy might have seemed like a really good alternative to a lot of women in particular who were married, because there weren't a ton of other options to avoid having a lot of children.
And their wives probably didn't have too many rights like today, too, so there might be some of that, right?
Yeah, but there was a great deal of equality and equity in these communities and in the families, the Shaker families, just because of the fact that that was one of their founding principles.
In fact, after the death of Anne Lee and a few leaders, the leadership settled on a man named Joseph Meacham, who had been a Baptist minister, and he was the one who brought his congregation into the Shaker Church. Meacham made a decision that there should be dual leadership in the Shaker, so there was a men's side and a women's side. So the leaders of the community were referred to generally as elders and elderesses. The Shaker, the common Shaker, was just referred to as a brother or a sister. There was always an order of elders and elderesses in every family. So if you were on the male side of things, you were directed by the male elder. If you were on the women's side of things, if you were one of the sisters, you were directed by the elders of the community. There were a lot of titles and jobs and people that did particular things, but in the end, if you look, it's just really split down the middle. So women had control of their own part of that Shaker life, and men had control of their own part. And if there was discussion to be had between the two sexes, it was done at the higher levels, not at the lower levels of the community. But it meant that women had the power of the purse in some cases. They earned their own money, their own industries, and everybody contributed to the whole, but they also had responsibilities thrust upon them to maintain certain parts of their side of that community. So if they were earning money, some of that went into maybe buying new pots and pans. Or men were doing that, and some of their money went into buying new farm equipment. So it's hard to know. It's people have not yet done a really good economic study of the Shakers and how that all worked. But it was part of the division of the men and the women. And it gave some women a lot of power.
Yeah, I could see where some women would want to join up because there was no other opportunities in society at that point for that kind
of... You picture the woman who has seven children and her husband dies. And, of course, at that period, her husband's brother inherits all her property. And he says, you can have 3 months in a cord of firewood, but then I want you out of my house. And she wanders down the streets, and the Shaker said, we'll take you and your children in, but you can't have any more children. Sounds pretty good. Anyway, I just wanted to go back to Dana because her job is to kick me when I say the wrong things. but the celibacy issue is also one where there aren't other communal societies that live a celibate life together like the Shakers did that succeeded.
It seemed like other groups of celibate people do not multiply by definition.
Well, they don't multiply and they don't live together generally. If you think about, the Catholic orders living celibate lives, but they're living in separate accommodations usually. But with the Shakers, I often say, it's that celibacy actually is probably part of the reason for their success, not for their failure. In fact, if you're not living in a celibate life, you have a certain requirement to tend to your husband, your wife, your children over somebody else's. Whereas when you're in a communal family and you've abandoned those ties with people, then it's about us. And I think the part about the Shakers, and I think one of the songs that Sarah's going to cue up here sometime, speaks to the issue that... you don't need to right now. I don't remember which one it is. But speaks to the issue that you have to really give up yourself in order to be part of the community. I think that's the hardest part of being a Shaker, probably, from what I can witness or read about, is people can't give themselves up to the community.
And I was going to go to Sarah Van Buren next, who many of our listeners will know as DJ SVB.
Hello. Yes, it is me.
What is your role at Shaker Museum?
So I'm working on public programs and community outreach, which is sort of how we landed here talking to you, Tom. Especially, as Jerry mentioned earlier, because this is a really auspicious year for the Shakers and for this history, and especially with the Shaker legacy in the Hudson Valley. It's an exciting time to be doing that work and to kind of get the word out. There's so many things to say. There's so many interesting things to say about the Shakers, and that's why we're, this is a quarterly meeting, so we'll kind of discuss different topics of Shakerdom each time that are all kind of linked to this place, to the Hudson Valley, and are also somewhat seasonal in nature. But yeah, so that's my job at Shaker Museum. So we also, you know, we've been doing some planning for 2024. We have some public programs. We're working on some things in Hudson, a few things in Hudson with the Hudson Area Library. And I can go into that at some point.
Do you have a song queued up?
Sure.
So yeah. I was thinking we play a song and then we come back and talk more about Shaker Museum.
Yeah, sure.
And you can get into all that.
Yeah.
About that.
And this one is called Little Children. I don't know if that's the song. Oh, no. Sorry. It's Love is Little. Is that the song you were thinking of, Jerry?
I don't know. Maybe it wasn't the song.
Okay.
All right.
It's called Love is Little, about universal love.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment on the WGXC Afternoon Show, the Shaker Show edition. You have tuned into the Shaker Show edition of the WGXC Afternoon Show. Sarah Van Buren, what was that we just heard?
Hey, Tom, that was Love is Little, which is from the early Shaker Spirituals album that was released by Rounder Records in sometime in the 70s. I guess I should look to see the date.
We're also joined by Dana Rasso and Jerry Grant of Shaker Museum, and we're going to hear more. So where is the Shaker Museum?
Good question. So do you want me to, I'll take this one.
Please.
So Shaker Museum has been based in Chatham since the 50s. However, we don't currently have a brick and mortar museum space. We're working on a new space in downtown Chatham, in the village of Chatham. So that's in process.
And do you need help with those efforts?
We do.
What sort of help do you need with those efforts?
I think the best way to help would be to go to our website and learn about what we're doing. Maybe Dana can advise best there.
Yeah, absolutely. Go to our website. And
what's that address?
It's shakermuseum.us. And one of the fantastic things about our website is that we have a searchable collection online of, we have over 17,000 objects of Shaker material culture and publications and things of that nature. And a lot of that is accessible on our website. And it's a really great learning tool. And it is also on our website where you can find ways to become a member, because membership does have benefits, even though we are not in the physical realm yet. And one of those benefits is we do monthly members-only tours of the collection, which is housed in Old Chatham, as Sarah said. And that's a pretty fantastic experience because of the fact that you are absolutely just surrounded by 20, like, you know, two stories of Shaker materials, and you have Jerry Grant telling you about them. And he has a story about every single piece in our collection, virtually every single piece.
And I guess it's a collection that, like, doesn't just tell the history of the Shakers, but tells the history of the United States, too.
Well, in a way, I've often said I haven't met too many people who I say, what's your interest? And they'll tell me and I can't find some shaker object to fit into what they're interested in. But I just wanted to add the Shaker Museum was founded publicly in 1950. It opened in the summer of 1950, but a man named John Williams had moved up here in the mid-30s and bought farms on what then I've learned was called Brown Trout Road, which is now called Shaker Museum Road, and bought a couple of farms up in that area, and he was always a collector. He had inherited a collection of Audubon material, and he continued collecting that, and he collected rare books. And when he moved up here, he became friends with somebody who thought they should start a museum having to do with agriculture in the Hudson Valley, which seems totally appropriate now. And I think before they got too far down the road, they had learned about places like the Farmers Museum and that there were other competition. But one of his farm managers said, if you're really interested in farming and agriculture and old tools, you should go see the Shakers up in New Lebanon. And they did, and he became totally intrigued with the Shakers. There were still Shakers living in that community. He became friends with theirs and had many, many conversations to the point where, and he started buying things from them. Now, if you picture the Shakers coming out of the Depression era, and they were people who had decided to always pay taxes on their land because they wanted to be able to fully participate in the rights of citizenship. So they'd pay taxes, continue to pay taxes, and they were pretty cash poor. And John Williams, they were often finding themselves selling off their surplus furniture and tools and machinery to collectors and antique dealers who always negotiated prices, of course, because they had to. But John Williams would just say, what do you want for that? And they would tell him a price, and he would basically pay them. And they liked that relationship. And they felt at some point they said, you know, Mr. Williams, you are going to start a Shaker Museum someday. And once they were convinced that he was going to do that, probably before he was convinced he was going to do that, they started sort of saving special things to make sure he had them for his museum sometime. And we have a number of objects that are like that, that were probably things the Shakers never would have felt comfortable selling, and yet were fine with giving them away to somebody who would help interpret their history and preserve their history through time. So that museum, as I said, opened in 1950, and we used to have people would remember antique festivals and herb festivals, and we were quite well known for our strawberry shortcake breakfast for a number of years. And what happened is the facility in Old Chatham just wore out. He started a museum in his barns. He had moved the cows out and moved Shaker stuff in. But the facility really wasn't adequate for any kind of ADA compliance or fire safety or security or environmental conditions. So there was a decision just to put things in safe storage as long as we could and to build a new museum. It's just circumstances have been, it's taken a while for us to get there, but we are on the move now, feeling good about it.
So how are those efforts going? You want to address that, Dana?
Yes. I mean, we are currently in the process of doing our capital campaign to get the building in Chatham, which is a former sanitarium, correct? But I think most recently was a furniture store or something. It's a beautiful building. It needs some structural work, and then it also is going to have an incredible modern wing put onto it, which has been designed by Seldorf Architects, which is an award-winning architecture firm. So we're still in the process of fundraising for that, and it's something that we kind of live and breathe on a daily basis at work. But we wouldn't all be here if we weren't really not just passionate about Shakers, but passionate about the fact that this museum is going to be. Like a world-class facility, and we want to make that happen.
for a world-class collection, because we have the most comprehensive collection of Shaker artifacts and archives in the world. Yeah. So,
and in no small part due to John Williams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we only have about 6 minutes left. So tell us about some of these 250th anniversary events this year.
Well, I'd say the first thing coming up on our calendar, so one thing we did not mention yet is, because we do not have a brick and mortar space, we have a pop-up gallery space where we have quarterly exhibitions, and that allows the public to interact with our collection in conversation with contemporary ideas, contemporary artists, contemporary art. So our next, and that's at the Kinderhook Knitting Mill, which is in the center of Kinderhook. It's on the second floor. It's actually above the Aviary and Morning Bird restaurants and below.
That's that new building with those good restaurants in it?
Yeah, it's the new building with the good restaurants. And we're below September Gallery, so we have like a little art zone. So
we are accessible via a motorized scooter or wheelchair as well, because we have an elevator.
Yes, a really nice elevator.
Yeah.
So the next opening will be featuring the paintings of local painter Caitlin McBride, who I believe is listening right now because she texted me to tell me when that song came on, the Love is Little song, her baby stopped doing what he was trying to do and started singing along to the radio. So Caitlin is an amazing painter, and she's actually in her work used a lot of Shaker objects and kind of elevated them, you know, everyday Shaker objects, and elevated them to this sort of totemic kind of role. And she's painted them in a photorealistic kind of way that's against these very colorful backgrounds. So her paintings will be on view in this space alongside some of the Shaker objects that she actually was using as her inspiration. And the opening is going to be on Saturday, February 3rd from 5 to 7 p.m. Obviously, you can find out more about that if you follow us on Instagram at Shaker Museum, or go to our website, shakermuseum.us. So that would be the first thing happening. And then, how much time do I have? A couple minutes? Next, we actually will have Caitlin, in partnership with the Hudson Area Library, teaching a teen and tween zine making, mini manifesto zine making workshop, which takes inspiration from Caitlin's show. She's going to be exhibiting some of the Shaker material, because essentially they kind of made zines. I know, Jerry, that would not be what the Shakers, he's giving me the thumbs up. Maybe that's not what they
were. It wasn't quite maximum rock and roll.
Yeah, exactly. but they were very prolific. They made so many publications, and so there's a real analog there. So we can talk about the Shakers' use of letterpress and printing, and how they got their message out to the whole world, and how can you do that today in an analog way that doesn't include TikTok or your phone?
If you want to start your own celibate religion,
yeah. So that's happening at Hudson Area Library on, I believe, Wednesday, March 28th. Wednesday, February 28th, and you can find out more about that visiting the library's website. HudsonAreaLibrary.org, also our website, also our Instagram, et cetera. You can also, on our website, sign up for our newsletter, and then you'll know about everything.
And what's that website address again?
ShakerMuseum.us.
All right, we got about 2.5 minutes. What else do you want to tell people before we go?
Well, we could kick it off with the Shaker banger of all time, which is Simple Gifts. I don't know if we want to leave it there unless...
I would like to just mention the Shakers themselves will be holding a conference in the beginning of August to celebrate the 250th anniversary, and it will be a multi-day event with speakers and programs, and if people have felt inspired to get into this with any depth, that's a place to look for, and that news will be, I'm sure, in newsletters and just in the general public, or just Google Shakers, Maine Shakers.org.
That meeting is going to be up in Maine?
Yeah. So,
And Dana, anything else we need to know about the Shakers or Shaker Museum before we leave
my,
for this time?
My esteemed colleagues have done a great job of covering it. Thank you.
But you'll be back again in 4 months or so?
In like April?
Yeah, we'll hear about, you got some more events coming up in the summer?
Yeah, we have a whole slew of programs.
I imagine the 250th year, there are many things to event or celebrate or do.
Yes,
that's true.
All right, you have a song queued up. We can go out for the last minute with something.
Yes, so this is Simple Gifts, which I think a lot of people will recognize from the early Shaker Spirituals album, which was sung by the Sabbath Day Lake community in 1976.
All right, thank you guys for being here.
Thank you,
Tom. Thanks for having us.
Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round, round.